We're going to start this evening by reading John chapter 21. We're going to read the whole chapter. After these things, Jesus showed himself again to the disciples at the Sea of Tiberias. And in this way he showed himself. Simon Peter, Thomas called the twin, Nathanael of Cana in Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, and two others of his disciples were together. Simon Peter said to them, "I am going fishing." They said to him, "We are going with you also." They went out and immediately got into the boat, and that night they caught nothing. But when the morning had now come, Jesus stood on the shore, yet the disciples did not know it was Jesus. Then Jesus said to them, "Children, have you any food?" They answered him, "No." And he said to them, "Cast the net on the right side of the boat, and you will find some." So they cast, and now they were not able to draw it in because of the multitude of fish. Therefore, that disciple whom Jesus loved said to Peter, "It is the Lord." Now when Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put on his outer garment, for he had removed it, and plunged into the sea. But the other disciples came in the little boat, for they were not far from the land, but about 200 cubits, dragging the net with fish. Then, as soon as they had come to land, they saw a fire of coals there, and fish laid on it, and bread. Jesus said to them, "Bring some of the fish which you have just caught." Simon Peter went up and dragged the net to land, full of large fish, 153. Although there were so many, the net was not broken. Jesus said to them, "Come and eat breakfast." Yet none of the disciples dared ask him, "Who are you?" knowing that it was the Lord. Jesus then came and took the bread and gave it to them, and likewise the fish. This is now the third time Jesus showed himself to his disciples after he was raised from the dead. So when they'd eaten breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me more than these?" He said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." He said to him, "Feed my lambs." He said to him again a second time, "Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me?" He said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." He said to him, "Tend my sheep." He said to him the third time, "Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me?" Peter was grieved because he said to him the third time, "Do you love me?" He said to him, "Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you." Jesus said to him, "Feed my sheep. Most assuredly, I say to you, when you were younger, you girded yourself and walked where you wished. But when you are old, you will stretch out your hands and another will gird you and carry you where you do not wish." This he spoke, signifying by what death he would glorify God. And when he had spoken this, he said to him, "Follow me." Then Peter, turning around, saw the disciple whom Jesus loved following. He who had leaned on his breast at supper and said, "Lord, who is the one who betrays you?" Peter, seeing him, said to Jesus, "But Lord, what about this man?" Jesus said to him, "If I will that he remain till I come, what is that to you? You follow me." Then this saying went out among the brethren that this disciple would not die. Yet Jesus did not say to him that he would not die, but, "If I will that he remain till I come, what is that to you?" This is the disciple who testifies of these things and wrote these things, and we know that his testimony is true. And there are also many other things that Jesus did, which if they were written one by one, I suppose that not even the world itself could contain the books that would be written. Amen. Now, you'll have noticed that our reading started with "after these things." So that kind of begs the question, after what things? So, where have we got to so far in the story of Peter? Well, the events immediately preceding chapter 21 deal with the resurrection appearances of Jesus. First to Mary Magdalene, but then twice to the disciples. And in this chapter here, we have the third appearance of Jesus after the resurrection, where Jesus appears to at least seven of his disciples. But the focus here is a little bit different. It's not on demonstrating the reality of his resurrection. The focus here is more on equipping and preparing the disciples for what lies ahead of them. So as the chapter starts, where do we find our disciples? We find them by the Sea of Tiberias, that's Galilee. And they weren't there by chance, were they? We know that Jesus had instructed his disciples to go to Galilee and told them that they would see him there. So the disciples have gone to Galilee and they're waiting for Jesus. We know at least there were at least seven disciples. There were Peter, Thomas, Nathanael, the sons of Zebedee, James and John, and two others, probably Andrew and Philip, since they came from that region. Now, it's interesting to see these particular disciples together, because Thomas, of course, wasn't present the first time Jesus showed himself, was he? He missed out on seeing the Lord because he wasn't there. And so he seems to be sticking fairly close to them now, just in case Jesus appears again. And then we have Peter. Peter who denied his Lord. He disowned Jesus for one night, but now he's being obedient. He's doing exactly what Jesus told him. He's going where Jesus told him to go and following the instructions he was given. So what were the disciples to do while they were waiting for Jesus to appear? They could have sat around and waited for Jesus to show up, but they didn't do it. Peter, as usual, comes to the fore and makes the decision, which and the rest of them seem to agree. So he says he's going fishing. Why was he going fishing? Well, he was a fisherman. And it's a logical thing to do. They had nothing else to do. The public ministry of Jesus had come to an end, and perhaps they were thinking of they need to earn some money. They've got no income now. And they're waiting as a fisherman by a body of water they knew well. They had access to a boat. So going fishing is the obvious choice, isn't it? But so why didn't it work out when they went fishing? They went out immediately, we're told. So they must have had this conversation in the evening. So immediately they go out, they get into a boat and they work all night. But they catch nothing. They were experienced fishermen, they had the right tools, they were working at the right time of night, and yet they caught nothing. What was wrong? Now, I wonder if Peter's mind is going back here, because he took another fishing trip on this lake a few years earlier where he caught nothing. And we looked at this fairly recently, didn't we? They worked all night, on that first occasion, they worked all night, they caught nothing. And then, when they were at the point of giving up, at a word from Jesus, those nets filled with fish. And now, the same thing. They work all night, the morning has arrived, and they have no fish. They look towards the shore, perhaps they're preparing to head back towards it, and they can see a figure there. The man calls out to them and says, "Children, have you any food?" Well, actually, he didn't actually say that. That's how our version here translates it, but if you look back at the Greek, it's actually slightly different. It's, "Children, you don't have any fish, do you?" So Jesus isn't asking them a question, because he already knows the answer. He's reminding them they haven't got any fish. He knows they've caught nothing, and now he's about to show them that these fish are his to command. But they don't know this. They haven't recognised that it's Jesus. It's probably only still early morning, maybe half light. The boat's a distance from the shore, and they can't recognise this man. But, whether they know who it is or not, they immediately follow his advice and they put the nets on the other side of the boat. And what happens? The results are instant. Verse 6 tells us they're not able to draw in the nets because of the multitude of the fish. It's a miraculous change from no fish at all to nets so full of fish they can't pull them into the boat. And that's enough, at least for John, to work out that this is Jesus they're talking to. That it's Jesus standing on the shore. So when he tells Peter, what does Peter do? He jumps overboard. He throws on his coat, he jumps and heads straight for the shore. Now, to me, that seems like an odd thing to do. The first thing you do is you put on your coat when you're going to jump in the water. But that's maybe he didn't want to meet Jesus improperly dressed. Maybe he still has something he wants to appear in the right way before Jesus. But for whatever the reason, he puts on his coat and he jumps into the water. But before he gets to the shore, let's have a think about this miracle for a moment. There are lots of things we could learn from this, but there's just two I want to draw out this evening. Now, we've seen that the miraculous catch of fish is almost a repeat of the earlier miracle recorded in Luke 5. How did that account end? It ended with Jesus telling the disciples, "From now on, you will catch men." So what happened after that miracle? They brought their boats to the land and they abandoned them and they followed Jesus. So what we have here is something of a recommissioning by Jesus of the disciples. I mean, we could say that Peter denied Christ, but on that evening they'd all run away from him, hadn't they? Peter wasn't the only one to abandon Jesus. So they'd all failed, and yet Jesus comes to the disciples and he demonstrates to them by the same miracle that he hadn't given up on them. He's reminded them of their original commissioning and telling them it's still in effect, and he still wants them to go out there and catch men. He still wants them to work despite their failures. But what is the second thing this miracle tells us? Well, this catch of fish, it reminds them that they will be successful in their work. But to be successful, they only succeed through the power of Jesus. I mean, they'd been out there working all night, and fishing was something they knew well. These are successful fishermen. They should have had a boat full of fish by this point. They were casting their net into the water, and they caught absolutely nothing. What was missing? Jesus was missing. And it's only when Jesus came with the promise of success they actually found the fish. By following the commands of Jesus, they caught the fish. But they only did so because Jesus commanded those fish to swim into the net. And what's the parallel here? Jesus had promised those disciples that they would catch men. And we can say those men were only going to the net because the Father draws them. Jesus said that people only come if the Father draws them to him. And that's what's pictured here by this net. Christ drew those fish into the net and he draws those men to hear the gospel. And he draws them to himself. Nothing came into the net unless it is drawn there. And that is from promise of success. And what happened? Jesus provided those disciples with an astounding catch of fish. Far more than they would have expected to catch in ordinary night's fishing, because they couldn't draw them into the boat. And yet, despite that, those fish were all brought safely to land without the net breaking. And it's by learning to rely on Christ rather than their own fishing efforts, their own expertise, that those disciples were equipped for success. And that's something we can apply to ourselves, isn't it? But let's go back. Because we left Peter struggling in the water, heading towards the land, didn't we? Why didn't he wait for the fellow fishermen with their nets? They were all coming to land now, so why did Peter feel the need to jump into the water? I mean, it's possible he wanted to get to Jesus as quickly as possible. But I think there may be another reason here. On the other occasions that Jesus had appeared to the disciples, it had been a group encounter, hadn't it? But maybe Peter is remembering what happened that night he denied the Lord. Maybe he's seeking an opportunity to speak with Jesus privately before the other disciples get there. But we don't know what passed between them before the rest of the disciples arrived on the land. We aren't told that, although maybe what happened immediately afterwards gives us a clue. Because when Jesus is speaking to Peter, is told us in verse 15 to 17, which is after dinner. and it's when everybody is present. So let's jump immediately to after dinner. Let's do that bit first. Jesus turned to Peter, and in verse 15 he said, "Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me more than these?" Now, I'm going to test your memory here. Back in October, when I was up here doing this, we covered a very similar conversation. We had Peter's great confession of faith. And how did Jesus address Peter on that occasion? He said, "Simon, son of Jonah." Now, I think the reason he uses that particular turn of phrase on this occasion is exactly the same reason. He wants to remind Peter of his ordinariness, his humanness. Because Peter was a fisherman, very little education, no natural advantage in life. So he couldn't succeed by relying on his own strength. I mean, when Peter failed Jesus, he did so because he was relying on human strength, on his own effort. And now, even with the fishing, he discovered what he thought he knew he wasn't actually very good at. He's relying on his own efforts. And it's only when Jesus commanded the fish to come into the net's filled. So, I think Jesus is trying to remind Peter of his own, that he's been relying on his own efforts too much, that he is trying to do things in his own way. I mean, let's look at the question itself. Do you love me more than these? Now, Peter was a little bit boastful. I mean, he has actually in the past boasted that he would not forsake Jesus, even though all the other disciples did. So when Jesus says, "Do you love me more than these?" Do you still think you love me more than these? And how does Peter reply? "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you. Not I love you more than these, but yes, you know I love you. Well, not quite perhaps as much as I thought I did." He prefers to acknowledge, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. And you know how much I love you as well. What does Jesus say to him? He says, "Feed my lambs." Now, who are the lambs here? They're the weaker, the less experienced ones, the ones who need the extra help, the ones that need that special care and attention. So what Jesus is saying here is reminding Peter that, yes, you say you love me, but love is not an abstract concept, is it? You demonstrate your love through what you do. So Jesus is definitely commissioning him here. He's saying, you're going to demonstrate this love to me through future service. I'm giving you a job to do. You go out there and you feed those lambs. But Jesus doesn't leave it there, does he? In verse 16, it's the same question. "Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me?" Now, Jesus does change the question slightly because he leaves out the comparison. Peter's already admitted that he doesn't love him more than these. So now it's just, "Do you love me?" And Peter gives the identical answer. "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." He's not boasting here. He's acknowledging his entire dependence on the Lord and confirming his love for him. And Jesus said to him, "Tend my sheep." So who are the sheep? Well, notice Jesus calls them my sheep. So yes, Jesus is echoing back to where Jesus calls himself the good shepherd and says that he knows his sheep. So these are the sheep of Jesus. As Jesus directed those fish into the net, which the disciples had lowered, he will guide his sheep into the gospel community and call out his people to feed and nourish them. So Jesus is saying, care for my sheep, those ones that I give you, just like I gave you these fish. And then again, we get the question the third time. "Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me?" Peter can only acknowledge that Christ knows all things and that Christ knows the extent of his love. What does it mean? You know all things, Lord. You know all things. You know that I love you. Well, Peter's acknowledging the omnipotence of Christ, isn't he? He knows that Christ knows all things. I mean, he's had this question three times, so he's going to be thinking back to the fact that he denied Christ three times. And to the fact that denial was predicted before it happened. So Christ knew that he would deny him. Christ knows all things. But this isn't done to humiliate Peter. This is done publicly. This is done to restore him publicly in the sight of all those disciples, everybody listening. They know that he is restored, and they know that he's been commissioned for future service. Because they're all listening to this conversation, thinking, well, we'll run away as well. Can Christ really use you after you've failed him, after you've run away? And this is the answer. You're recommissioned for future service. And you're told to go and to feed the sheep, the others that need feeding, that need to hear. So Peter is equipped for future service. But what kind of future service is that? I mean, we jumped a bit, didn't we? Because the disciples reached the land, and what happened then? Peter walks over to them and he hauls the net onto the shore. But what was the first thing the disciples saw when they came to the land? The answer is in verse 9. As soon as it came to the land, they saw a fire of coals there and fish laid on it and bread. Now, I think that surprised them a bit. Where did these fish come from? They weren't any of their fish, were they? Their fish were still in the net. Probably Peter was still holding the net to the shore. So Jesus didn't get those fish from their net. But he's already prepared fish and he's already cooking them. So where did they come from? They knew no other fishing boats had landed there and dropped off any fish. So where did these fish come from? They were Christ's fish. Christ didn't need the disciples to produce fish, the same way he doesn't need them to produce more disciples. He doesn't need them to bring people into the kingdom. But Jesus chooses to use them. He tells them, bring some of your fish to the fire. We're going to cook those as well. I mean, Jesus could have prepared more enough breakfast for them without the disciples. He'd already proved that more than one occasion. Yeah, he wants to use them. He wants them to bring their fish. He wants to use them in his service. He wants to use them to bring their fish to the fire and complete that meal. He wants them to share in the work. In the same way he wants us to share in the gospel work. He doesn't need to use means to bring people to himself. He wants us to share in his work with him. He wants to use means. This is a picture for us. We stand in the same work, proclaiming the same good news as the disciples. And we look for Christ to bring home his sheep, or in this case his fish. But why did the disciples need this reassurance at this point? What was about to happen? Well, humanly speaking, they were going to be left alone, weren't they? They're going to go out there and they're going to be trying to proclaim the gospel, and Jesus isn't going to be there helping them. Not humanly speaking, anyway. They're going to feel very alone. All the time up to this point, Jesus has been physically with them, teaching them, guiding them, showing them what they should do. Very soon, he's going to ascend to heaven, and they're not going to see him anymore. I mean, it's true, the Spirit is going to descend, and they're going to have the Spirit inside them, but that's a very different thing. They're going to feel very alone. Their ministry was changing. And they needed exactly this picture, Christ guiding and drawing his sheep, drawing them into the net. The disciples were going to preach, and they needed to know they're not going to be the ones ultimately responsible for the results of that preaching. Jesus threw the fish into the net, and is more than capable of drawing in the people. He told them, be fishers of men. If I can draw these fish into the net, I'm going to draw the people to you. He would use the preaching of the disciples to do the work, but he was still going to be the one guiding. He's still the one responsible for how that work pans out. So if that's the result of the work, what does this service of Christ, what does this work actually look like? I mean, Jesus gives Peter insight into this in verse 25. And this may be, verses 18 and 25, this may be why they need that reassurance especially. I mean, that's not the most encouraging picture really, is it? He goes and tells Peter, you're going to die. So Christ is going to be leading the work, but this is not going to be easy work. I mean, Peter has just reconfirmed his love for Christ, and Jesus told him that the reality of his love will be demonstrated by his actions. And this does show Peter going on to future service. This is when you are old. Now, Peter was still a fairly young man at this point. I mean, Jesus has just called them children, so this is not, it's not something you would use an older person necessarily. And this is, he says this will happen when you're older. So yes, it confirms Peter will do future service there. But it does show this is not going to be easy work. How does Peter respond to this? Well, he doesn't say he's unwilling to die, but this is Peter, isn't it? So we talk about him immediately, he changes the subject. He says, what about him? He wants to know whether John is also going to die. And Jesus doesn't give him a direct answer as such, does he? He says, well, he focuses Peter's attention on what's important. He says, what's that to you? You come follow me. I'll deal with what happens to him. You come and follow me. That's what you're, that's your job. So Jesus reminds Peter and us that we're not to be too concerned here in what others do for their service for Christ. We can't be constantly comparing ourselves with them. What about you? What about the success or failure of that ministry? Well, it doesn't matter. We're to be concerned in what we've been called to do. We work for Jesus and we focus our attention on what we've been called to do. And we shouldn't be envious of the system's success or maybe doubting their faithfulness because of someone's failure in ministry as such, because we can't see the immediate success there. We leave that to God. He's the one who judges righteously in all things. I mean, he gives or withholds human success. We're called to discharge our duty faithfully. And that's how we demonstrate our love for Jesus, our love for God. By our love for each other and our faithful service in the proclamation of the gospel. But we leave it to Jesus to see how successful he wants us to be, or how humanly successful. Because if we achieve what he wants us to achieve, then we are successful. Whether we see hundreds or thousands converted, we see one or two. We are successful because we do exactly what he called us to do. And that is success. And that's what we're going to leave here for tonight.